Hi, and welcome to episode 8 of the Unpacking Weight Science podcast called Theoretical versus Actual Weight Change, Industrialized Wishful Thinking. I'm your host, Fiona Willer, weight neutral professional development dietitian, academic and size acceptance advocate. Today I'm going to compare and contrast what our mathematical formulas about energy requirements and weight loss say should be possible, i.e. the theoretical, versus what actually happens in real life. And I'm also going to talk a little about the history of this energy requirement belief system, who continues to use it and why. Our learning goals are 1. To develop familiarity with the equations used to determine energy requirements, their utility and margins of error. 2. To understand the historical context of energy deficits to elicit human weight loss. And 3. Recognize the features of literature and sources which use a theoretical basis versus an evidentiary basis to claim weight loss success. So first, a quick content warning. I've tried to avoid mentioning specific calorie amounts where possible, but there are some that I couldn't avoid. So if hearing calorie calculations is an eating disorder trigger for you, please tread really carefully here. So basically, we've got the stuff we do with individuals, which attempts to be individualized. Then there's the stuff that appears in public health campaigns, which is definitely not individualized, but the public can't really tell that it isn't. Food industry advertising then capitalizes on the language and conventions used by health messages to appear to give consistent advice and thus sell their products, because they like people to think they've got the actual health of their customers in mind. Selling something with a promise that health comes with it is called health washing or cultivating a health halo. Diet products use the myth that weight loss is a surefire way to gain health as literally their sales pitch, and a sales pitch for the products that would literally not exist without fat phobia. The basic principle for weight loss is set up the circumstances where energy balance is in deficit, so the body will have to cannibalize its own tissue to continue to function. Using own tissue means that the actual body mass will be turned into breath, heat, and movement, and then the body ends up lighter. So that's the theory. For individuals, we calculate their energy usage or try to predict their energy requirements, look at lifestyle and eating patterns, and try to look for ways to drastically reduce the amount of energy from food that's consumed and increase the amount of physical activity that they do to really increase that deficit, that gap in energy intake. And we've been using that method officially for almost 100 years. So I've had my head in this literature for a long time, and I at one point tried to find the earliest mention of a dietitian working in weight management. And that paper was published in the 1920s, 1928. And essentially, things are unchanged today, the way that dietitians do things technically. They use the same premise, principles, and also misplaced sense of optimism about effectiveness. I mean, that paper from 1928, when you read it, it is very similar to the sorts of stuff that is in research papers around weight loss today. So how do we work this stuff out? Well, we can try to measure energy expenditure, so the amount of energy actually used by an actual individual's body, or we can estimate requirements using a predictive equation, or try to figure it out from the amounts and types of foods that they're eating, and then taking away the energy used in activity by what they've reported. All of these methods have issues, of course, but the figures are actually pretty irrelevant, unless you're really sick. I'm trying to calculate how much tube feed you need if you're super duper sick, or I'm trying to figure out whether I've allowed enough food to meet the needs of a captive population, like if I'm trying to feed a jail population or a school population. Once that's worked out, it's essentially like trying to calculate or predict the usual operating expenses of a business that's breaking even. Then we reduce that budget and make the business operate on a reduced income in order to force it to shed some assets, downstep productivity, or streamline services. The process of weight loss is also quite like a business which has had to make cuts due to financial pressure. So the business owner is out there hustling with all their might to try to increase productivity again, taking every opportunity that comes along and making a big song and dance about it. Bodies don't like to lose weight and will fight weight suppression more and more rapaciously with every attempt of weight loss. For groups and populations, public health guidelines use what they have deemed the recommended energy requirement of an adult because, yes, it would be absurd for every label and all campaign materials to have to use super complicated equations to personalise them. The magic calorie number used for the average adult is the same in the US, the UK and Australia, but in the US and the UK it's referred to as a recommended daily intake for an adult, with a disclaimer that you may need more or less depending on circumstances. So it's suitable for no one, essentially. But interestingly, and I only found this out in the process of researching for this podcast, in Australia, the phrase that has to be on our food is percentage daily intakes are based on an average adult diet of 8,700 kilojoules, or about 2,000 calories. So that's really interesting because what they're implying in the Australian statement, I didn't know what the statement was, but I had forgotten or not looked deeply enough into the meaning of it. In Australia, they're saying that the average Australian adult intake is around the 2,000 calorie mark, and that's just not right. Like, it's actually factually incorrect. I'm going to come back to that little news flash later. Anyway, then they show how much of that a serve of their product contributes towards that magic number. And the thing is that energy requirements vary hugely and they differ from day to day. And we already have a system that regulates this beautifully. We don't have to white knuckle it from the outside in. Trying to reverse engineer appetite is total folly. And I'm now going to tell you why. So let's tackle the abbreviation salad that is human energy requirements. So we're going to look at BEE, BMR, REE, RMR, TEF, AT, TEE, and EER, and a few others, which I forgot to add to that list. I'm going to start with the ones that attempt to measure energy usage and then move on to the methods that we use to predict energy requirements. So some of this may be familiar to people who have to use it every day. For others, this may be new stuff. So it is getting probably more technical than I have gotten in other podcasts in the past, but in any case, there you go. So first, basal energy expenditure, or BEE. It's the same as basal metabolic rate, BMR. It's the minimum amount of energy expended by that individual's physiology to sustain life over a 24-hour period. So it's the lowest amount of energy required to do that. Now, that figure is usually pretty consistent from day to day for an individual and is measured upon waking from a long sleep and more than 12 hours after any food, drink or stimulants like caffeine or nicotine have been used. And you can think of it, it's that lowest possible, a bit like energy, a bit like standby mode or sleep mode for electrical appliances. And then the test results for that are then extrapolated up to a 24-hour period to form that BMR rate. The next one up, the next higher figure is the resting energy expenditure, or REE, which is sometimes called RMR, or resting metabolic rate. Again, it is a amount per 24-hour period, unless stated otherwise. It's higher than the BMR, and it incorporates the usual human physiological functions like breathing, circulation, cell activities, maintaining body temperature. It's about 10 to 20% more than the BMR. It doesn't take into account the energy required for movement or digestion of food. So RMR is influenced by body composition, so how much fat and muscle tissue and connective tissue and water and all sorts of stuff is in your body, by the climate, by your sex, whether you're male, female, somewhere in between, hormones, stimulants, age, growth requirements, body surface area. But the most energy is taken up by the heat produced by our busy organs. So our liver, brain, heart, spleen, and kidneys basically means if you've got large organs, your RMR may be higher. Weight for weight, tall people have higher RMRs than shorter people. And also during energy restriction, like during dieting, for example, or starvation, RMR can be pushed down by up to 15%. These figures, resting metabolic rate, basal energy expenditure, and metabolic responses to exercise tests can all be measured using your breath. So by capturing all the gases breathed out in a certain time period and essentially calculating how much carbon dioxide and how much oxygen is in there and looking at the ratio between those two gases, and that gives you what's called the respiratory quotient. And from that, a BMR or RMR can be extrapolated. That's the most accurate way to do it. But it's thrown off if people haven't eaten enough prior to the test, so they have to fast. But if they've been essentially fasting for a number of days, then that's going to throw out the figures because it will be suppressed, lower than it would otherwise have been. And if they haven't followed those test protocols to the letter, then it may well be inaccurate for them. It sort of gets put into the bucket of, yeah, that's nice to know for the physiologist, but it's not overly useful for me bucket. So you're not likely to encounter this type of equipment unless you're in the intensive care unit or at a respiratory specialist clinic. So I use it for people with a condition called COPD, where they're unable to breathe effectively, just to check how their gas exchange is going. You might also see it in universities and at research centres. So when my university got a bod pod years ago, we didn't hear the end of it, and everybody was clambering over themselves to think of excuses to have to use the new toy in their research. In situations where the expensive equipment and time isn't available to actually try and directly or more directly measure BMR or RMR, the way that dietitians and other clinicians calculate those figures and calculate energy requirements overall is to estimate them by using some equations, some mathematical formula. They're not super difficult equations, but they're all complicated enough for clinicians to feel like they're doing something important and special and specialized, and imbue the clinicians with a false sense of accuracy about that final number that they spit out. Just like BMI is a pretty crappy metric overall, part of its allure is that it can be calculated to a few decimal places and it feels technical and accurate, all the while being not a very good measure of anything much. So although there are well over 100 different equations to calculate these energy requirements, the main equations used are the Harris-Benedict equation, the Mifflin-St. Jour, and the Schofield equations. Now basically, Harris-Benedict is old school. The US recommends using the Mifflin-St. Jour, and down here in Australia, we still use the Schofield equation in our nutrient reference values, and that's also the one that the World Health Organization still likes. Firstly, let's check in with the Harris-Benedict. So this one was developed a decade before that first dietitian-y weight loss paper was published, 90 years ago, in 1919. Back before any automated calculations were possible, it was amended in 1984 when they realised how inaccurate it was. 1984, that's a long time past when it was calculated, and far, you know, like the technology was already available to be able to be more accurate way before the 80s. Anyway, it uses gender, age, weight, and height to estimate BMR, but not yet the activity. I'm going to talk about the physical activity part in a sec. The Schofield equation was published in 1985 and is what I was taught at uni almost 15 years ago, and is used more in Australia and Europe and is preferred by the WHO, as I said before. It uses age group, sex, and weight, but not height, to predict BMR, but it isn't great for larger people or older people. And then the Mifflin-St. Jour equation came onto the scene in 1990, again using height, weight, age, and sex, and is about 5% more accurate than the Harris-Benedict, but it was derived using only normal and what was deemed overweight people, so it's even less accurate for lower weight or people with BMIs greater than 30. There are also various methods that just use a set amount of energy per kilo and so aren't adjusted then for sex or age. And using these methods that just scale up with weight is problematic because we know that the larger the body, the less energy per kilo contributes to RMR. Now we're talking about accuracy. What's the deal? Are they fit for purpose? Do they measure what they set out to measure, and is there a reason for doing it that's worthwhile? Again, like I say in probably every one of these podcasts, is that they would be the most accurate collectively for a group, because that's literally how they were derived in the first place. But at an individual level, they can be fairly inaccurate. So a test of 150 people in Scotland found that the range of actual BMRs in their test group was as large as the average BMR itself. And it has a lot to do with lean body mass, so everything that isn't fat, muscle, gut, skin, water, etc. But even when controlled for fat-free mass, bodies can vary in the realm of 30%, which is hundreds of calories of energy requirements, and something that these equations just can't calculate for. Then in terms of extra energy needs, we've got the TEF, the thermic effect of food. That's basically how much energy it takes to digest and use the food that you eat. It's about 10% of your total energy expenditure, the TEE. Okay, so then we add up all the energy that's used with physical body movement, and that's called activity thermogenesis, or AT. That's physical activity, getting around, sports. Sometimes a non-exercise bit is called non-exercise activity thermogenesis, or NEAT. Activity thermogenesis is the bit that is over-relied upon in the energy out component of those theoretical weight losses. Activity thermogenesis is really hard to measure accurately in real life. Unless you can measure all energy expended by heat, respiration, movement, you've got to rely upon more indirect methods, like putting them on a pedometer or similar activity monitor on someone, or getting them to complete an activity survey. They're the least sort of intrusive methods. All of these methods have pretty eye-watering amounts of measurement error and may not accurately present usual non-monitored life, because being monitored does change human behavior. To try to reconcile these differences with something of practical use, physical activity levels, or PALs, are used to scale up the base energy requirement. You take the estimated base requirement that you got using your Harris-Benedict or Mifflin-St-Jean or Schofield equations and multiply it by an activity factor to get an overall estimate of the energy requirements. Each one of those equations has its own set of activity factor values. So you've got to use the right set for the equation that you've used to work out the base energy requirements. An alternative way is to break down the separate physical activities and calculate how much energy was used using METs, or metabolic equivalents. That's still based on the REE. In people who are severely ill, we also use an injury or stress factor, as they have higher energy needs too, depending on how medically compromised they are. The most technically accurate but expensive way to work out someone's average total energy expenditure, or TEE, is by getting them to drink some water that's been engineered to contain deuterium oxide and oxygen 18, and that's called doubly labelled water, or heavy water. As the deuterium water molecule is about twice as heavy as a regular water molecule. And then monitor the difference in concentrations of those two water isotopes that were in the heavy water. We have a look to see how much is left in wee, saliva, or blood plasma over the next couple of weeks, because the difference between the two indicates the amount of carbon dioxide that's been created. And thus, just using the same equations as we did for the breath ones, the amount of energy expenditure can be calculated. So doubly labeled water isn't radioactive, but drinking lots of it can cause DNA issues and symptoms similar to radiation poisoning. Okay, so to summarise, basically we've got methods to work out someone's energy expenditure, that is how much energy someone actually uses, and if we can't access those tests, then use equations to attempt to predict how much energy someone's body probably needs. And this can be corroborated by figuring out how much energy someone eats from taking a diet history and energy that they use by taking an exercise history. Total energy expenditure, TEE, is RMR, resting metabolic rate, multiplied by the sum of 10% of the RMR for thermic effect of food, and then a physical activity factor or injury factor if they're unwell. To streamline that process, a set of estimated energy requirements tables were produced, giving the base requirements and corresponding physical activity options for each sex, age, height, and weight. In Australia, these tables are in our nutrient reference values and dietary guidelines, except they're scaled only for a BMI of 22, which has actually never been the average of the Australian adult population. And even for those with a BMI of 22, that magical 2,000 calorie intake figure that I was talking about before, that average Australian intake, would suit only shorter bedbound adult men or sedentary elderly men, and is insufficient for any man under 50 years old with a BMI of 22 or over who's able to get up and move around and is still considered sedentary. It does hit the mark for shorter, less active and older women, but as soon as you're taller than 160 centimetres or walk around for work or leisure or have a BMI greater than 22, it's probably not enough for you either. I mean, I can't even with this stuff. If they're going to put labels on foods and on menus that indicate what the average person eats, at least it should actually be factually accurate, because it, you know, there are many people who would eat twice that and be at a stable, healthy weight. So, rant over. Well, maybe not quite over. In the hands of medical and hospital professionals, this stuff, this number stuff is fine. But when it overflows into the arms of the public, it's weaponized for people with a susceptibility to eating disorders. Because of its air of scientificness and accuracy, it's then assumed to be better than the tools that we already have for gauging how much to eat. And, you know, if the numbers were actually right, maybe, just maybe, I would have less of a problem with it. But the fact that the bar in terms of energy intake expectation is so low, it's just ridiculous. It's utterly maddening that that number is just everywhere. In practice, clinicians tend to have the equations or tables that they're familiar with and they like to use, rather than selecting one based on which population it's more accurate for. And some workplaces like hospitals or health services insist that a specific equation is used in preference over others. Also, in the real world, the variation from what the equation says to what the person actually needs to maintain their weight becomes blindingly obvious in a hospital setting, because feeds and intakes need to be reassessed really frequently. You never know who's going to need an extra bunch of energy to stop them from wasting away while they're in hospital. But of course, it's actually the same out in ambulatory humanity. There is a huge amount of variation even amongst people who look the same, even amongst people who on paper their body composition is the same, but the physical activity is the same. So much of it is derived from genetic components and other individual factors that we're really incapable at this point in history in grouping people together in groups that are similar enough in order to do any sort of weight or physiological testing that's actually meaningful, because everyone's jumbled in together with all of their different proclivities for weight change. It's impossible. Well, I mean, what we can predict is there's going to be a range of reactions to having a weight loss intervention or to having any sort of food or activity related intervention. We just simply don't know enough yet. So I'll come back to this another day, but also the other elephant in the room is the fact that those lovely, accurate sounding numbers on food labels do not necessarily accurately represent what's in the package. And what's written on the label or theoretically in that piece of produce is not fully available to absorb into the body either. And the degree of availability of that energy and those nutrients varies from person to person and day to day, even with the types of bacteria in your bowel. And that you can't really change that much, no matter what the yogurt producers say. And that contributes also how much from the food you end up actually absorbing into your body out of your digestive tract. So we use one or more methods to work out energy intake versus requirements. For larger people, an adjusted body weight is sometimes used, which is essentially 25% of the difference between their requirements if their BMI was 25 and their requirements at the BMI that they are in real life. Then we take off 500 to 1,000 calories to prompt weight loss. And initially, this is a great trick, particularly if the person hasn't weight loss dieted before, because it does work in the short term. You lose water weight and a bit of body mass initially, but mostly because the calorie deficit is pretty huge. If you compare with your total requirements, the deficit is a huge, taking away a huge amount of our normal intake. Continued weight loss may be sustained for a few months before slowing and then slowly regaining, despite the people still trying to do all the things. The pattern on literally every graph of a weight loss intervention study shows this pattern, and it's acknowledged in a Level A evidence statement from Australia's NHMRC, which is our highest medical and health research council, that weight losses are maximal at 6 to 12 months, with regain for most back to baseline within 2 to 5 years. The more weight that is lost, the stronger the biological forces will step in to try to bump it up again. So let me be clear, even if people continue to eat the same amount of energy that they were eating during their diet, during their weight loss diet, the body will slow down that weight loss. It is trying to protect itself. It is having an existential crisis because of what it only can assume is a famine. Because what human in their right mind restricts their food if they have food available and they are hungry? So that 500 to 1,000 calories, let's talk about that. So the maths used to figure that out literally came from the composition of a kilo of human body fat tissue, which is not completely pure fat. There's also fluid and cell walls and proteiny bits and blood volume and stuff in there. But the point is that the numbers recommended to elicit this quite specific amount of weight loss weren't derived from human studies of how much energy restriction was necessary to lose those exact numbers, which of course would involve hormones and individual variation, etc., but literally from looking at the composition of some fat tissue and working out how much energy was literally in it by using a bomb calorimeter where you stick it in and basically burn the crap out of it, and the amount of heat produced is how many calories were in it. Now, bodies are not actually bomb calorimeters either, but that's how calorie content of foods and things are derived. But anyway, so they worked out how much energy was physically in that tissue and then divided it by about a week's worth of days and just assumed that the body would sort the rest out. In real life, when there aren't enough calories to go around, muscle tissue is used as an energy source, including fat tissue, which is partially why repeated rounds of weight loss dieting result in decreases in muscle mass and increases proportionally in fat mass. It's not only the muscles you can see that waste away too, it's also your organ muscles, your heart muscle, intestinal muscles, and it's not like you can take your guts to the gym to bulk up. Once they're wasted, they may never recover to their former fitness. People who have had, for example, anorexia or conditions where their body muscle mass has wasted will know that pain particularly. You know that even when their body is back to a weight that the body's comfortable in relatively functioning well with, the function of the guts isn't fabulous. It takes a long, long time to recover that gut function because the muscles are literally weak from all of that starvation. Okay, so here we start really to wade into mythical territory using that concept of X kilos is equivalent of X calories. So this is the basis for the use our product and save X calories for every snack, etc., etc., and the rationale for all dietary products. So rather than targeting some kind of specific intake goal, they take what's called a small change approach, fiddling a bit with this and that to decrease energy intake, which on paper looks like it should result in weight loss over time. Except here's the thing, the body isn't an appliance that takes the same amount of energy from the electricity socket every day, like the TEE and EER calculations would have us believe. While we have relatively stable base energy usage, our actual dietary intakes in terms of both volume and energy vary hugely from day to day. And I've got some studies which show the energy intake in individuals versus weight over day to day. And we seem to have this reconciliation system that occurs over a period of weeks. It's nowhere near reconciled in terms of energy intake and energy output on a day-to-day basis. Nowhere near. So experimental studies show that small decreases in energy intake, like if you switch from full milk to reduced fat, are completely reconciled by metabolic adjustments without any weight loss. And the opposite is true too. Small increases in energy intake don't lead to weight gain in everyone. The body just essentially runs hot for a few of those days to use the excess. And that's called adaptive thermogenesis, if you want to dip into this literature. Human weight regulation via changes to intake and activity, as I said, occurs over a period of weeks, not days. Hunger, intake, activity, and weight all fluctuate outside of our conscious awareness. It's a decidedly unhuman thing to eat the same amount of energy every day, yet that's what diets call us to do. Again, contrasting the theoretical with the actual, a 1% difference between input and output of energy, if persistent, will theoretically lead to a gain or loss of about 10 kilos per decade. But that's not actually what happens in free living humans. And we can't detect differences in the 1% level of intake output anyway. Well, we do know that over time, a large proportion of the population does tend to gain weight, while still fairly decent proportion of the population tends to maintain their weight whilst eating literally the same as the people who are gaining weight are eating. Very low energy diets can suppress energy metabolism by up to 10%, so essentially trying to conserve energy. I call this, and the other decreases in physiological activity during weight loss, metabolic austerity. Basically, the body's on an energy budget and cuts back where it can, dials down the RMR, suppresses the immune system eventually. This is why inflammatory markers decrease eventually during dieting, not because of some magical effect of being smaller, it's that becoming smaller is the part that's doing the work. After the diet is done and weight has been lost and regained, overall energy requirements are usually less than they were before the diet began. And that's accounted for by loss of muscle during dieting, which is not fully replaced with the weight regain. So, to sum up, we have yet another case of humans falling in love with being able to measure stuff, and again, assuming that we can outsmart our incredible metabolic body machine. Failure to include the realities of the impact of human environments, culture, behaviour, and long time frames leads to false conclusions which can have catastrophic consequences for people. In weight science, researchers have overwhelmingly used the lab rat model of research, looking only at physiological processes, coming up with a solution and expecting people and bodies to simply do the things they advise, and for bodies to keep doing the things they initially observed in the lab indefinitely. However, just like medication, even if the medication is technically clinically effective, if the process of taking the medication is difficult, doesn't suit the person, has side effects that people don't like, psychological or physical, or is compensated for by something with more severe outcomes than the original complaint, then the medication isn't fit for purpose and is actually ineffective, perhaps harmful in a real-world setting. So that's it for this episode. The supporting materials, which include the show notes, research links, and self-test quiz, are available upfront for current subscribers, which is only $5 a month, which is a bargain, or can be purchased in a bundle if you're catching up later. And you can have a look at unpackingweightscience.com for details. Next time is Ethics versus Morality: Why Fat is Fraught. This episode will delve into theories of human morality and medical ethics and their role in fat phobia. I'll unpick the concepts and meaning of fatness through these two lenses in order for listeners to be able to identify which meaning system is at play in those who force their weight centrism upon others and select a line of discussion that hits its mark. So until next time, goodbye.